she added, a room far away from Mrs. Carrie Cat. Her room was stifling, and she was not accustomed to Nashville summer heat. It was nothing like the cool mountain night air in Monteagle. But she came up with an ingenious solution. Miss Pearson sat naked in the bathtub, cold water trickling onto her toes, a candlestick telephone in her hands, and began her work. She gripped the telephone shaft and spoke into the daffodil-shaped mouthpiece.
"Line me up with New York,"
she directed the switchboard operator. Upon completing one call, she went on to the next. She had a long list.
"Put me through to Boston."
She had orders to relay. She had forces to mobilize. And so into the night she sat.
"Connect me to Mobile."
From the depths of her moist refuge, Josephine Pearson called her allies around the country, those who stood ready to provide the resources required for this fight to defend American civilization. Into the telephone she sounded the alarm.
"Mrs. Cat is here. Send help. We are under attack."
Chapter 2. Lay of the Land. In the morning, on the third floor of the Hotel Hermitage, Carrie Cat clipped her pince-nez eyeglasses onto her lacy blouse and prepared to survey the battleground terrain. It was a minefield, that was certain. Nashville was one of the few American cities she'd not visited on a tour or campaign, but she had traveled to other parts of Tennessee. The first trip was with Susan Anthony in their 1895 swing, it might be better described as a trudge, through the southern states, trying to drum up interest in votes for women. They made their way through 5 states in 4 weeks, rallying, educating, and organizing clubs. They preached the suffrage gospel in cities and small towns, but the South was hard ground for sowing suffrage seeds, the social and political culture unyielding. To save money, they stayed in the homes of host suffragists, and Cat often had to share a bed with Aunt Susan, who was, thankfully, quite thin. Cat returned to Memphis in 1900 as the featured speaker at the Tennessee Equal Rights Association State Convention, and again in 1916 as the newly re-elected president of the National American Woman Suffrage Association, attempting to heal the rupture within the state's suffrage ranks. To her mind, it was a stupid argument. The Memphis ladies didn't like the Nashville and Chattanooga ladies. Their noses were out of joint because Memphis hadn't been chosen for the 1914 the National Convention. It wasn't about tactics or ideology or anything significant. It was a catfight, plain and simple. Cat had naively thought she could breeze into town and broker a peace accord, but she failed. The warring suffs kept at one another for several more years. At the same time, Cat had her own suffrage rift to deal with, the one with Alice Paul and her contingent. But that was about strategy and philosophy, she believed, not personality. The Tennessee women did manage to patch things up enough to put a limited suffrage bill through the legislature the previous year, but it was by all accounts a near thing. They were splintered anew by this gubernatorial race. Suffragists opposed to Governor Roberts refused to work with suffs who supported him. The governor refused to work with any suffragists who opposed him in the primary, or even women whose husbands opposed him, all those he considered his enemies. Republican suffs were leery of working with Democratic suffs, lest a Democratic state get credit for putting the amendment over the top. And then there were the Woman's Party people, going their own unpredictable, and to Cat's mind, unhelpful way. At least there weren't too many of them here. Competing ratification committees were being formed. Separate polls of the legislature were being taken. There was harping all around. Cat had no patience for this. It was embarrassing and dangerous. She knew that if the political men of the state discovered such internal strife among the suffs, they could easily dismiss the campaign for the amendment as a woman's fight and find plenty of excuses for declining to ratify. They'd unpack the old chestnuts. Women were too emotional, too high-strung for the rough and tumble of political life, too inclined to hair-pulling spats. Cat resented having to play referee in this sorority squabble,
The issues were so petty, so parochial. For heaven's sake, she had just convinced the British, French, and Germans to peaceably work together. Just a few weeks earlier, at the International Woman Suffrage Alliance meeting in Geneva, she'd had to walk gingerly through the grim, emotional detritus of the recent war. As president of the alliance, Kat was thrust into the role of conciliator among women whose nations had been slaughtering one another for 4 years. Some of the European delegations initially refused to attend the conference if the German representatives were present. Belgium did not attend. If they couldn't agree to sit in the same room again, the alliance was doomed. Behind the scenes, Kat maneuvered the agenda to take resolutions of blame and retribution off the table. Then she initiated a tea-time diplomacy, inviting the British, French, and German leaders to her room before the conference began. She fed them tea and sweets, got them talking, coaxed them to set aside their anger and grief, fixed their sights on their common goal of helping women achieve political and economic equality. Over pastries, the head French delegate extended her hand to her German counterpart. The conference was saved. Kat had quietly, cunningly, diffused an explosive situation. Somehow, Tennessee seemed more daunting. Not that Kat was ever a woman to shrink from a challenge. She possessed a serene confidence and a steel-sheathed-in-velvet manner for getting her way. When her father had discouraged Carrie's plans to go to college, a girl didn't need that sort of education, and in any case he couldn't afford to send her. She wasn't deterred. She simply found a job teaching school and saved enough money to put herself through Iowa Agricultural College, washing dishes and stamping library books to pay her board. When she joined the Literary Society and was told only the male students could give orations, she broke school tradition by insisting that female students also be allowed to speak publicly. Her male classmates had a debating society, so she formed a female debating counterpart. The men had compulsory military drills, so she petitioned that the co-eds be offered the same kind of physical training. She graduated first in her class in 3 years. After Carrie decided to become a lawyer, but didn't have the funds for law school, she prepared by reading under a prominent attorney and working in his office to earn money. She was surprised one day to receive a telegram offering her a job and a salary she could hardly refuse. Come to Mason City, Iowa, and become principal of the high school. She thought she was taking only temporary leave of her law books, but soon she found herself promoted to the post of superintendent of schools in Mason City, one of the first women in the nation to be appointed to such a position. There was considerable skepticism about this 24-year-old woman's ability to tackle the district's administrative and morale problems. Student discipline and truancy were at a point of crisis. The new superintendent needed to prove her mettle. On her first day in office, Carrie Lane taught her high school classes in the morning and then began to make the rounds of the other district schools. In her handbag, she carried a 2-foot-long leather strap, which she had recently bought at a harness shop, a handle loop sewn on one end made to fit her hand. She walked into the first school, reviewed the list of recent truants and misbehaving boys, and called them out into the hall, one at a time, asking them to bring a chair with them. She instructed each boy to remove his coat and lean over the chair, and proceeded to use her strap to teach him a painful lesson. She made her way through the other district schools, inflicting pain and tears. When she returned to her office, she placed the strap conspicuously atop her desk, settling the matter of her resolve. It was a useful exercise for her future career in suffrage politics. Superintendent Lane soon gained an admirer in town, Leo Chapman, the handsome publisher and editor of the Mason City newspaper, who was dazzled by the tall, dark-haired, silver-tongued Carrie. Leo brought Carrie into the newsroom to join him as co-editor and publisher. They were true partners, but barely 18 months after their wedding day, Leo was dead, typhoid taking him at age 29. A stunned young widow, Mrs. Carrie Chapman demonstrated the sort of resilience that would become a hallmark of her character and her legend. This talent, for bouncing back and pushing forward, proved essential at every crossroads of her life. Carrie spent the next 4 years as a single working woman, scraping together a living, writing freelance articles, editing newspapers, and giving public lectures on various topics. She suffered the kind of crude sexual harassment so common in the workplace. A businessman she was interviewing grabbed her and tried to force himself upon her, thinking any working woman must be a loose woman. She was horrified and began to understand what women faced when they ventured into a man's world. Carrie also began earning money as a paid field organizer, first for the Temperance Society, then for the Iowa Woman Suffrage Association. While she'd always been a strong supporter of the suffrage movement, ever since that moment in her family's kitchen, she hadn't thought of it as a career. Veteran suffragists quickly recognized her potential. She was a brilliant speaker, brimming with what people called magnetism, and she was an organizational dynamo. She soon gained notice in national suffrage circles. Susan Anthony kept a close eye on this up-and-coming Iowa suff. In 1890, she married again, giving her hand to George Catt, a civil engineer who was making a name for himself, and a very comfortable living, as a bridge builder on the West Coast. They became a team to work for the cause, as Carrie liked to put it. George gave her the economic freedom and the loving support to devote herself to suffrage work. "My husband used to say that he was as much a reformer as I," Carrie once explained, "and his role was to earn living enough for two, and I could reform for two. That was our bargain, and we happily understood each other." Carrie and George moved to New York City, where George had his own engineering business, and Carrie worked with Susan Anthony as a national organizer of suffrage campaigns. She became one of Aunt Susan's girls, part of a coterie of young apprentices and acolytes, nieces, as Anthony affectionately considered them. In 1900, Anthony chose Carrie to succeed her as president of the National American Woman Suffrage Association, believing she possessed the skill and the fire to carry the cause into the 20th century. It was rumored that Carrie and George had long ago signed a nuptial contract, guaranteeing her 2 months each spring and fall to travel, wherever she was called, for suffrage organizing. It's doubtful there was ever any such contract. That would be much too formal and legalistic a way to express the manner in which the couple worked together. They simply had a mutual, silent agreement. They were a team for the 15 years of their marriage, until George's health began to deteriorate. Carrie resigned the presidency to take care of him, but he died soon after, at 45, in 1905. Carrie was shattered. She lost interest in suffrage. Her own health collapsed. She moved out of the comfortable Manhattan apartment she'd shared with George. The memories were too painful. Moved into a hotel and asked her suffrage lieutenant and friend Mary Molly Garrett Hay to stay with her as a roommate. She couldn't bear to be alone. She and Molly had been together ever since, living and working as a new team. With Molly's help, Carrie slowly recovered, submerging her grief. She lost George, her mother, her brother, and Susan Anthony all within the space of 2 years in work. While she kept her hand in the affairs of the National Association as a vice president, she redirected her energies into building an international suffrage movement, co-founding the International Woman Suffrage Alliance with her friend Millicent Fawcett of England. She made an around-the-world trip to survey the condition of women in China, the Philippines, Africa, and India, and to spark new suffrage groups. She came back to New York, home to Molly, and they embarked upon a quest to win the vote for themselves. With the federal amendment stalled in Congress, Carrie and Molly set their sights on increasing political pressure by winning suffrage in a trophy state, the nation's most populous, New York. Carrie and Molly combined their talents to wage a New York State referendum campaign in 1915, which failed, but they went right back to work and succeeded in 1917. The victory convinced more nervous politicians that suffrage was a winning proposition, and is credited with providing leverage for the federal amendment. In the midst of their referenda work, Molly also encouraged Kerry to accept the presidency of the National once again in late 1915, convincing her that she was needed to steer the listing mothership of suffrage, which seemed to have lost its way. Then they worked together to execute Kat's winning plan for the federal amendment, and over the previous year, to win ratification. They were a formidable pair. Molly liked the rough and tumble of backroom politics. Some likened her to a Tammany Hall Pole. Like Kerry, Molly was a Midwesterner from Indiana. Unlike Kerry, Molly was very blunt, even abrasive. Many suffragists simply did not like her, and many were jealous of her close relationship with the chief. They discussed politics as other couples might talk about the weather, as a natural phenomenon subject to endless fascination. One friend said Kerry was a statesman, Molly a politician, and together they were invincible. But it was hard for Kerry Catt to feel invincible this morning in Nashville. Marjorie Schuller entered the room. She was tall and athletically trim, with lustrous dark hair, rosy cheeks, and full lips that usually broke into a ready smile. Today, however, poor Marjorie looked very haggard. She'd spent most of the past week chasing after the governor, his friends, and his many foes all over the state. The reports she'd wired to headquarters could curl your hair. Kat at first assumed that Marjorie must be overreacting, being a bit melodramatic. She was young and impressionable. But now Kat sensed that Marjorie hadn't been exaggerating at all. The newest set of complications was that Luke Lee, former U.S. Senator, influential publisher of the Nashville Tennessean, and political rival of the governor, planned to print a cutting satire of Roberts in his paper. The parody would emphasize Roberts's political paranoia and his equivocating on the ratification issue, zeroing in on his insistence on a friends-only ratification committee. If this mockery hit the streets in the pages of the city's leading pro-suffrage newspaper, it would embarrass the governor. He might renege on his promise to call the legislature into special session to consider ratification. And, he had hinted darkly to Marjorie, possibly withdraw his shaky support for ratification altogether. During the past few days, Marjorie had frantically tried to broker a compromise. She'd tracked down the governor somewhere on the campaign trail and convinced a Nashville suff with a car to drive her there. She'd pressed him to agree to recognize the official League of Women Voters Ratification Committee, chaired by his enemies, Abby Milton and Catherine Kenney, alongside his own hand-appointed committee, headed by his loyal supporter, Kate Birch Warner. He refused. He wouldn't countenance Milton and Kenney. The most he would allow was appointment of a couple of neutral political women to his own ratification committee. Marjorie then motored all through the night, arriving back in Nashville at 5 in the morning to present the compromise deal to Luke Lee. He rejected it. Newspaper attack on chief executive postponed only on condition of immediate arrival of our chief, Marjorie wired in a panicky telegram to the national headquarters in New York. Kat fumed, but she was on the train to Nashville less than 48 hours later. Catherine Kenney moved briskly through the downtown streets toward the Hotel Hermitage. The city was quiet, slowed awake on this summer Sunday morning, groggy from the heat. The shops on Church Street stood locked under rolled-up awnings. It was the Sabbath. Nevertheless, this was going to be a very busy day. More than 100 of the city's most influential citizens would be coming to meet Mrs. Catt at the hotel. Kenny arranged it all on very short notice and was forced to handle all the social niceties and political intricacies of the occasion alone. Everyone was away just when she needed them. Ann Dudley, former Nashville and Tennessee state suffrage president and a vice president of the National under Mrs. Catt, was still out west after the Democratic National Convention in San Francisco. Abby Milton, president of the new Tennessee League of Women Voters, who was also a delegate to the convention, was obviously taking the slow, scenic road home to Chattanooga. Kate Warner, the governor's pet suffragist and newly named chair of his official ratification committee, had the audacity to be vacationing in cool Michigan. Kenny would be away, too, if she had any choice. Nashville in deep summer, at the bottom of the Cumberland Basin's bowl, was not the most pleasant place to be. Kenny booked Mrs. Cat into the Hermitage, the most elegant hotel in town. Mrs. Cat insisted she would stay in Nashville only 2, at most 3 days. She meant to set things on a proper course, then go home, as she'd done in other ratification states. In truth, Cat didn't believe Tennessee could pull itself together to act on ratification at all, so no use staying very long. But Kenny had a different plan. Mrs. Cat must remain in Nashville to the end, till they put ratification through. They needed her. Outside Cat's hotel window, the stars and stripes flew above the Tennessee state flag atop the Capitol building. The state flag reflected an important truth. Tennessee had long been divided. With 3 bold white stars barely contained within a blue circle, floating in a sea of red, the flag offered a graphic depiction of the state's 3 grand divisions and the historic regional tensions between the mountainous east, the rolling hills of middle, and the flat deltas of West Tennessee. The mountaineers of East Tennessee, where cotton plantations and slaves were few, resisted secession during the Civil War and remained loyal to the Union, fighting against their Johnny Reb Tennessee brothers. The scars remained. The East Tennessee Unionists stuck with the Republicans during the bloody Reconstruction period and long after. In 1920, East Tennessee remained a Republican Party stronghold in an overwhelmingly Dixie Democrat state. 1/3 of the legislators in the Tennessee General Assembly were Republicans, and they had the power to tip a balance. The big cities of each region sometimes acted like squabbling siblings. Memphis in the West Division, jealous of booming Nashville in the middle. Knoxville and Chattanooga in the East Division, envious of the other's wealth, swinging their allegiance for best advantage. The grand divisions were also enshrined legally in the state constitution, specified in the judicial system and expressed culturally in distinct accents and even musical styles. Appalachian bluegrass in the east, gospel in Middle Tennessee, and Memphis blues in the west. These regional differences and animosities colored the general political landscape and certainly spilled over into the state suffrage groups. It was just a fact of life, something you had to take into account as a Tennessee suff. But it was hard to explain clan fights to an outsider. Kenny had tried to capture the sense of things for Mrs. Cat with a dash of her usual down-home humor. "You know we Tennesseans and Kentuckians are rather strong on feuds," she told Mrs. Cat just the previous week. "Sorter drink it in with our mother's milk." That was a nice way of putting it. Kenny wasn't convinced that the state's suffrage split, though silly, was so harmful. Last year, they all managed to work together to push the limited suffrage bill through the legislature, giving Tennessee women the vote in municipal and presidential elections. Kenny was in charge of the Suff's publicity campaign, which appealed to Tennessee men's vaunted sense of chivalry, while also making veiled threats to the state's ego. "This bill will place our state among the progressive ones," the Suffs told the legislators, "and belie the present indication that it is reactionary and slow in taking up new and progressive ideas." They brought the Speaker of the State Senate over to their side, and even convinced a few of the red handkerchief boys from rural East and West Tennessee to go along. Tennessee women's record of selfless work during the war certainly seemed to sway some votes. And in a moment Kenny would never forget, on the day of the vote, the Speaker of the House, the handsome and ambitious Seth Walker, experienced a hallelujah conversion, just as in a revival meeting. It was so thrilling. Walker had been openly opposed to the suffrage bill, but suddenly, with no warning or explanation, he switched sides. Kenny and all the Tennessee Suffs were in the gallery of the lower house, mouths agape, as Walker stepped down from his high perch at the speaker's desk, walked onto the floor of the chamber, and, like a man who'd been born again, announced that he was now converted to the cause of woman suffrage. He declared that his former stand in opposition was wrong, and he was now convinced of the justice of enfranchising the women. He told his fellow legislators that suffrage had been granted to Negroes and that it should not be withheld from their own white women kin. What's more, Walker reminded his colleagues, the American colonies fought Great Britain over taxation without representation, and the same principle was at the heart of the suffrage issue. Women pay taxes and must obey the law. "I declare to you that this is not right," he boomed, "and that they should have a voice in our government." "It would be a crime and a shame," Walker insisted, "if women were not given this right." The chamber erupted into cheers. The Suffs never quite understood why the speaker switched sides, but no one was going to look a gift horse in the mouth. Walker's change of heart no doubt brought more delegates over to favor the limited suffrage bill, but the governor's people were still convinced it would go down in defeat and never reach his desk. Their headcount was wrong. It narrowly passed. The governor was not pleased. The Suffs had to twist both his arms and legs, but he signed the bill in the last hour of the last day possible, as if he were waiting for the clock to run down and save him. He signed it, Kenny was sure, only because his advisors told him it would be declared unconstitutional. The antis did try to get it tossed out by the courts. Kenny was told the governor was secretly supporting the antis' lawsuits, but they failed. The Tennessee Supreme Court dismissed the case. Tennessee became the first state in the Deep South to give women such voting privileges, and Kenny was very proud of that. Tennessee women still had no say in choosing their state representatives or U.S. congressmen or senators, or their governor, but it was better than nothing. Now it was going to take stronger muscle to get Governor Roberts to make good on ratifying the federal amendment. Of course, the Tennessee Suffs were also taking a risk in bringing Mrs. Catt here. The newspapers were full of her arrival, not only in the Tennessean and the Banner, but in the Chattanooga News and Memphis Commercial Appeal and Knoxville Journal, and in the wire service dispatches in all the small-town publications. There were already whispers about Yankee carpetbaggers coming to town, and Mrs. Catt herself was sure to become a lightning rod. But they would simply have to take that chance. Suffrage had been Catherine Kenny's ticket into Nashville Women's Society, Protestant Society, where Catholic women like her were rarely admitted. It would be a stretch to say she was also admitted into Nashville's highest social circles. Those were still off limits to her. She was also an outsider, a native Chattanoogan from a large, very poor Irish family, which didn't help her social standing. Her father died in Chattanooga's yellow fever epidemic, leaving her mother to support 6 children under the age of 10. Young Catherine was considered very clever, began studies at a Catholic high school, but she could stay for only a single semester before starting work at age 16 to help the family scrape by financially. She married an ambitious fellow from Nashville and moved to that city, and she moved up in the world. As her husband's Coca-Cola bottling plant prospered, they were able to move out of the Irish section of Nashville and into the fashionable west side of town. Catherine could join the right civic organizations, the do-gooder leagues, where her can-do attitude was valued. She also climbed on the suffrage bandwagon and was welcomed into the Nashville Equal Suffrage League. The Catholic Church was no great friend of woman suffrage, it was true, she often had to explain to her WASP friends. But while many high-profile cardinals and bishops railed against suffrage, the church actually had no set dogma on the subject. Catherine Kenny chose to be a good Catholic suffragist. And Catholic clergy were certainly not the only men of the cloth to castigate the idea of women's enfranchisement, she was quick to remind her friends.
"When you hand her the ballot, you simply give her a club to knock her brains out," Reverend T.H. Harrison once proclaimed from the pulpit of Nashville's Adams Presbyterian Church. "When she takes the ballot box, you've given her a coffin in which to bury the dignities of womanhood."
Whatever your religion, it took some gumption to be a Suff in Tennessee. It wasn't a very respectable calling. You had to grow a thick skin. You had to laugh about what people and the clergy said about you, and what most of the other women in town thought of you. Your husband and children had to be able to let the nasty words and queer looks roll off their backs, too. Kenny put herself on the line when she presided over the very first suffrage parade in the South, the Great Procession in Nashville in May 1914. She'd directed it all, the flower-decorated automobiles driving through downtown, and the stunning suffrage tableau performed on the steps of the Parthenon in Centennial Park. Some said it wasn't ladylike to parade through the streets like that, but Kenny managed to make suffrage enticing and fun, and the good publicity spurred the growth of local suffrage clubs around the state. Mrs. John Kenny, 46 years old, saw herself as a suffragist, a Catholic, and a Democrat, but most important, as a mother of four children. It was motherhood that led her to suffrage, made her realize how important the vote would be for protecting her children and making their world safer and healthier. The abstractions, those greater goods of justice and democracy, were all fine, but it was the concrete things, such as better schools, safe milk, and decent hospitals, that drove women like her to want and work for the vote. Now all those years of work might be coming to fruition, right in her own backyard. Kenny walked into the hotel through the ladies' entrance on Union Street, unless accompanied by a gentleman, that was the only proper way to enter, and the uniformed operator took her to the third floor. She needed to explain just who was expected to make an appearance today, how they fit into the political picture, how useful they might be, how trustworthy, and with whom they were aligned. That was crucial. Above all, Kenny needed to shine a positive light on the circumstances. The Suffs of Tennessee were determined to prove to the chief that volunteer state women could, as Kenny put it, do something else besides fuss. As Mrs. Catt had ordered, the Tennessee Suffs had put together a men's ratification committee. "Get the biggest and most important men of the state," Catt insisted, "and do it quick before the opposition has made it impossible." They signed up almost 200 men of all stripes, from the state's U.S. congressmen to city mayors and rural legislators, sympathetic clergymen and businessmen, Republicans and Democrats, all headed up by former Governor Tom Rye. As Catt instructed, they'd printed all of the men's names on official letterhead stationery. They had to shrink the type very small to fit them all on the page. Most auspicious, two very prominent men, the publishers of the rival newspapers in town, Luke Lee of the Nashville Tennessean and Edward Stallman of the Nashville Banner, men who couldn't agree on anything in the world, had both signed on to the men's ratification committee. They detested each other, but they both joined, even contributed a bit of money, and said they would be coming by to greet Mrs. Catt this Sunday. At different times, of course. If these men both backed ratification in such a public way, it only proved how broad support for the amendment really was in Tennessee. Even the delicate racial theme was moot in Tennessee, Kenny assured Mrs. Catt, who could only give her a sidelong look of skepticism.
"I don't believe the nigger question will be raised here," Kenny maintained, "since Negro women have voted now in the five largest cities of the state, and many of the towns, and in every instance have made good. The suffragists organized them, and they voted with the best white women, thereby eliminating any political prejudice," Kenny explained with pride.
In the 1919 municipal election, Kenny had worked with Nashville's leading black suffragists, whom she considered intelligent and very able women, mothers like herself, to register black women and get out the vote. It made her proud to be a Tennessean. It made Carrie Catt nervous. Unless Tennessee was different from every other southern state, and Catt doubted that, there was no resting easy about that particular issue. In most respects, Catt admired Catherine Kenny's political instincts and clever footwork. She'd executed a beautiful maneuver a few weeks ago, in late June, when Governor Roberts was still balking at calling the special session. Kenny went straight to the top, to the White House.
"Our governor says Woodrow is his Moses," she explained, and he'll stand by him and follow him forever."
So Mrs. Kenny deployed the Moses on Pennsylvania Avenue, the Virginian president who had publicly endorsed the 19th Amendment to soften the heart of the governor of Tennessee.
"I conceived the idea of having the president wire him a loving message telling him to deliver the 36th state for the Democrats," she crowed.
It was a brilliant ploy. The governor was sunk. He agreed to call a special session the next day. Now Kenny presented Mrs. Catt with the results of the first poll of the legislature conducted by the Suffs in every district of the state. Catt studied the poll results, noticing that only about one-third of the members of each chamber had responded. Kenny explained that many delegates simply hadn't replied or had refused to commit just yet. There were also some influential men who leaned favorably toward ratification, but weren't yet ready to be placed on the definite yes list. Seth Walker, the Speaker of the House, for one. Kenny described to Catt, in dramatic detail, Walker's surprise conversion to the cause last year, how he'd helped swing votes for the limited suffrage bill. Walker hadn't yet committed publicly, but was letting it be known that he would support ratification, and possibly even introduce the ratification resolution in the House himself, giving it his imprimatur. "That would be a great boon," Kenny told the chief. The first in a parade of visitors knocked on Mrs. Catt's door. Scores more followed. District chairwoman of the new Tennessee League of Women Voters, the league, launched by Catt in February 1920, was already established in states where women enjoyed some degree of suffrage. Democratic Party ward chairmen, local politicians who'd bravely stuck their necks out for women's suffrage long ago, and wary strivers watching to see how the political winds might blow. They lined up to shake the hand of the chief, and Catt displayed her remarkable talent, a politician's talent, for making each of the visitors feel important. She looked them straight in the eye, asked them specific questions, cocked her head thoughtfully as she listened to their replies. They all sang a version of the same refrain. Tennessee could do it. It could definitely be the 36th state. If only she would lead them. Mrs. Kenny noticed that Major E.B. Stallman, publisher of the Nashville Banner, was not among the visitors. Personally, Kenny was relieved not to have to deal with Stallman. He could be so unpleasant, so abrasive. But his absence was puzzling. Perhaps he didn't want to encounter Luke Lee, but not showing up at all was simply rude. The stream of visitors continued into the afternoon, but the buzz of conversation abruptly stopped when Lee strode into the room. He was the sort of man who strode, never just walked, and certainly never ambled. He was tall, 6'3", and broad-shouldered, youthfully handsome, with pale eyes, carefully combed hair, and full lips that curled into a slight smile. He was a sharp dresser, and moved, always quickly, with an air of utmost confidence. Some might call it a swagger. He was the scion of a distinguished Tennessee family. His grandfather had been a mayor of Nashville, and he was raised on the 1,000-acre ancestral estate, Leland, just outside the city. After college, he went north to Columbia University Law School in New York City, then came home to Nashville. He was an ardent, dry man, not so much for moral reasons, but because he felt the liquor interests held too much sway in Tennessee politics, as did the railroads. He fancied himself a progressive reformer in the Theodore Roosevelt mold. He was for busting up the trusts, regulating the railroads and other corporations, and enacting prohibition. And well before T.R. came over to the Suff's side, Lee supported woman suffrage. He decided the most efficient way to promote his worldview was to have his own megaphone. So when he was barely 28 years old, Lee founded the Nashville Tennessean. He was its owner, publisher, and editor. He gained influence with men who wanted his support, and in 1911, the Tennessee General Assembly selected him as the state's junior U.S. senator. This was before direct popular election of senators, when state legislatures held that power. He was the youngest senator ever sent to Washington, only 31 years old. They called him the baby senator. Carrie Catt knew Lee from his time in the U.S. Senate. where he was a steadfast friend of suffrage, and, remarkable for a Southern senator, a solid supporter of the federal amendment. The Suffs could always count on him, and he was a champion of other progressive legislation as well. But before Lee's first term was over, the 17th Amendment took effect. State legislatures lost their ability to appoint senators, and Lee had to run in a popular election to retain his seat. The Democrats were splintered. It was a chronic condition. And he lost the primary election to Kenneth McKellar, the candidate of Memphis boss Edward Crump. Soon after Lee returned home to Nashville, the nation went to war. Though he was almost 40 years old by then, Lee recruited a brigade of Tennessee volunteers to fight as the Old Hickory Artillery Unit, and he took command. Colonel Lee grew a mustache, looked smashing in his high boots, and led his unit in some of the fiercest battles in France. After the armistice, while Lee and his men sat in Luxembourg, bored, waiting to be shipped home, he had time to think about the war and the precarious peace. He decided it was simply not right for the German Kaiser, the man responsible for so much misery around the world, to be sitting in luxurious asylum in a Dutch castle. The Kaiser should be forced to go to Paris, where the terms of surrender were being drafted, and stand trial for his war crimes. Lee was a man of action, and decided to take international matters into his own hands. He would kidnap Kaiser Wilhelm. He gathered up a few of his best men, got hold of some automobiles and fake passports, and took off with his little crew on what he told them was a secret mission. It was so secret that Lee's superiors knew nothing about it. The party posed as journalists, bluffed their way through border crossings, found their way around a washed-out bridge over the Rhine, and talked their way into the moated and heavily guarded castle where the Kaiser was kept.
"We wanted to bring him to President Wilson as a Christmas present," Lee explained.
Lee and his men got within earshot of Kaiser Bill, but were sent packing by armed guards. They climbed back into their autos and scooted back to base, returning without the president's Christmas gift. Lee came home a hero, marching with his men through the streets of Nashville and Chattanooga in the welcome home parades in the spring of 1919. At the ceremonies, no one mentioned the little matter of Colonel Lee nearly being court-martialed for his Kaiser adventure. Lee's bravado was part of his charm, personally and politically. Lee looked much older, his face more lined than Cat had remembered him in Washington just a few years ago. The war, of course, but also the news he'd received while on the transport ship coming home to the States and the welcome parades. His wife was dead. No warning. Gone, leaving him with two young boys. He buried himself in work, co-founded the American Legion to give war veterans a voice. But the boys needed a mother. So now, just over a year later, he'd married his late wife's youngest sister. They were planning a new family. He was a very busy man. Cat thanked Lee for his continued help and support, then got down to brass tacks. This parody of the governor he was planning to print. It was so dangerous to the ratification effort, it could cost Tennessee, and possibly the amendment. She didn't exactly plead, but issued more of a calm, cool-voiced order. Lee listened. He was a man who relished a fight, and Mrs. Cat was demanding that he stand down. After a long pause, Colonel Luke Lee reluctantly but gallantly agreed not to publish the parody, but only if the governor would agree to acknowledge other ratification committees besides his own. "Mind you," Lee emphasized, "this agreement did not mean his paper would relent in its critical coverage of Roberts." Mrs. Cat agreed that the First Amendment could not be sacrificed for the 19th. The matter concluded, the colonel strode out of the chief's suite. One down. Now, the governor. Chapter 3. The Feminist Peril. Josephine Pearson's night in the tub had been uncomfortable, but her phone calls remarkably fruitful, yielding pledges of help and funding from national and regional anti-suffrage coalitions. On Sunday morning, she was reading through the flurry of overnight telegrams delivered to her door when Mrs. George Washington and the Nashville delegation of the Tennessee State Association Opposed to Woman's Suffrage arrived at the hotel to greet their president. They were horrified to find her in such a cramped, sweltering room, and aghast to learn she'd spent the night in the tub. They whisked her to a much larger, airy corner room with a pleasant view, never mind the cost. No reason to sacrifice comfort, they assured her. There will be money enough for this fight. Meanwhile, their able ally, Nashville attorney John Jacob Vertrees, was at his desk in his summer house in Florida, on the phone with important friends and clients. Josephine considered John Vertrees her mentor and champion. She felt he'd discovered her, recognizing her skills and leadership potential, molding her into the proud anti-commander she'd become. Before he even met her, it was Josephine's pungent anti-suffrage essays, published in various Tennessee newspapers, that caught his attention. Vertrees was a respected attorney, former newspaper publisher, and state Democratic Party leader who represented liquor industry and railroad clients in his lucrative practice. Vertrees and his wife, Virginia, were both staunch opponents of women's suffrage, and they enjoyed reading Josephine's colorful public diatribes on its many dangers. Modern Eve asks for the forbidden fruit that may give out its essence of deadly poison in the possible disruption of home, and admired her zealous defense of the spirit of the woman of the Old South. The Vertreeses soon began to court her to take an active role in the state's fledgling anti-suffrage movement. Until 1913 or so, when the Tennessee Equal Franchise Association began to gain some traction, there was no need for an anti-woman suffrage movement in the state. Almost everyone was safely against giving women the vote. But when suffragists such as the socially prominent Anne Dudley began to make political and popular inroads, gaining some male friends in government, and when they dared to parade through the streets in yellow flower-bedecked cars and make speeches from flag-festooned platforms, the Vertreeses woke up to the uncomfortable realization that woman suffrage was becoming socially acceptable, even in Tennessee. They vowed to stop it. The Vertreeses organized the Tennessee State Association Opposed to Woman Suffrage, with Virginia as president and John heading the men's contingent, bringing his lawyer friends, Nashville businessmen, and Vanderbilt University faculty into the group, while also forging ties to the loose amalgam of anti-suffrage societies already established around the country. Vertrees held strong moral and legal objections to giving women the vote, which he pronounced in his 1916 manifesto to the men of Tennessee on female suffrage. With the publication of this pamphlet, Vertrees took on the role of philosopher of the state's antis. He assembled all the hardy specimens of opposition. Women were irrational and not intellectually equal to the responsibilities of suffrage. They were too emotional and sentimental to vote on policy matters. Government was based upon force, so only those who must bear arms should be allowed to vote. And suffragists advocated free love and personified loose morals. Extending the reach of his biological claims, he reminded his readers that women's dual physical handicaps, pregnancy and menses, rendered them unfit for public duties.
A woman's life is one of frequent and regular periods marked by mental and nervous irritability, when sometimes even her mental equilibrium is disturbed.
He also added the characteristic Southern twist to the standard antithesis. If handed the ballot, not only would Tennessee women be torn from hearth and home and plunged into the depravity of politics, but the social order would be irrevocably disrupted, as equal suffrage would nominally place black women on the same political plane as white women. He quoted the zealous suffragette, Miss Helen Keller, who, in her letter to the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, urged all to advance gladly towards our common heritage of life, liberty, and light, undivided by race or color or creed. Encouraging this kind of dangerous racial equality would undermine Southern society, he thundered. The region's social fabric had already been ripped apart 50 years before, first by the Civil War and then by Reconstruction. The racial rules had been shattered, societal relations disordered. Even by 1920, the South had not emotionally recovered from the trauma or reconciled itself to the concept of racial equality. For educated men such as Vertrees, who'd lived through the war and its convulsive aftermath, the threat of black women's enfranchisement, imposed by the federal government, seemed like a bitter reprise of the disruptions Washington had wrought decades ago. Beyond all his other arguments, Vertrees framed the suffrage discussion with blunt simplicity.
"I do not believe the women of Tennessee want the ballot. But even if they do, it is not a question of what women want, but what they ought to have. And it is a question for men alone to determine."
Vertrees's attitude wasn't unusual, and it wasn't new. Men had always taken for themselves the prerogative to decide for women, unilaterally determining what women should do, prescribing what they must not do, announcing which rights women were entitled to have. Men decided what was best for women, without their consultation or consent, then wrote laws to codify this judgment. That was the way of the world, learned men liked to say, claiming God had bestowed upon them such authority. One half of humanity held dominion over the other half, by right of a certain shape of genitalia. Just as American men had once taken it upon themselves to decide whether their wives were their property, now they were called upon to rule on whether it was best for women to be granted equal citizenship. In the future, this awesome sense of male responsibility would take other forms, involving other issues. Future generations of American women would continue to chafe as men in positions of power presume to control their bodies, the training of their minds, the choice of their professions, the pursuit of their livelihoods. Mr. Vertrees kept his eye on Miss Pearson as her letters were printed in the state newspapers, and she gained a reputation for feisty advocacy of the anti-point of view. When illness forced Virginia Vertrees to retire from the presidency of the Tennessee Anti-Organization in early 1917, Pearson was the obvious choice to replace her. The Vertreeses had to convince Pearson to accept the position, but once they did, she jumped into her new role with gusto, taking on the suffragists as the legislature debated a limited woman suffrage bill. Pearson became the public face of the anti-campaign to defeat the 1917 suffrage measure, but Mr. Vertrees was always close behind. It seemed never necessary for our anti-suffrage women to even climb the Capitol steps, Pearson recalled, and Vertrees did not want them to climb those steps, giving her strict instructions to keep the anti-women away from the State House. He would handle the lobbying. Josephine shared Vertrees' disapproval of women lowering themselves into the muck of politics, especially when the honor of Tennessee women was at stake. The antis won that fight, thanks in no small part to Mr. Vertrees' manifesto, which meshed so well with the thinking of many legislators. And they won despite William Jennings Bryan's big pro-suffrage speech in the Capitol building, which was high on florid oratory, but didn't swing many votes. But by 1919, the situation had changed. John Vertrees was still smarting from that humiliating defeat last year, when the suffrage people bamboozled the Tennessee legislature into giving women some voting rights. Not full rights, very limited, but even a little was too much as far as he was concerned. They claimed the time had come. The world had changed. The women had earned it by their war work. All such specious arguments. The legislature hadn't been manly enough to stand firm. The governor caved in and signed. Vertrees flew into court, attempting to nullify the new law, have it ruled unconstitutional because it didn't provide for women voters to pay a poll tax, as men were required to do. The lower court sided with Vertrees, declaring the law unconstitutional because the state constitution did not provide for woman suffrage, and the legislature didn't have the power to change that. But then the Tennessee Supreme Court slammed him down, reversing the lower court's decision, holding that the legislature did have the power to enact presidential and municipal suffrage. The suffrage law was amended to include a poll tax for women, and was declared valid. Women were at the polls in last fall's city elections in Nashville. He saw them. White and black women. John Vertrees wasn't going to let that happen again. So this Sunday morning, he was on the phone with his colleagues in the American Constitutional League, the men's legal arm of the Antis, who were eager to help him fend off ratification in Tennessee. The Constitutional League lawyers were already contesting several of the completed state ratifications, in Ohio, West Virginia, and a few others, claiming the ratifications were illegitimate. Should the Tennessee legislature take up ratification, a contingent of league lawyers, armed with motions and maneuvers, was ready to take the train to Nashville as soon as Vertrees gave the signal. Vertrees also rang up his longtime legal clients in the railroad and liquor industries. They had their own reasons for helping him fight suffrage. The Whiskey Boys were hoping that damned 18th Amendment, prohibition, would not be enforced. That was certainly the plan in Tennessee. But if women were allowed to get mixed up in voting and politics, especially the strident, dry ladies, they might insist on enforcement. The textile manufacturers didn't want women having a say in government, especially those labor reform types. After labor reform, they'd move swiftly to child labor laws and wage and health protections for women workers. It could get expensive. And the railroads were dead set against women voting. The Louisville and Nashville and the other railroad lines had bought the Tennessee legislature long ago, keeping it in its pocket with free passes and cushy jobs, with the understanding that the legislature would be friendly to railroad interests and take a hands-off approach to railroad regulation. This comfortable equation could be easily upset by unpredictable women voters. Anti-activists such as Vertrees and Pearson would have to admit that their work had grown more difficult in the past few years. The swing toward public acceptance of women's right to vote, once so slow and hesitant, with successful surges punctuated by reversals, had lately speeded up. There were no public opinion polls to statistically chart the attitudinal shifts that create pressure for political change, but there'd been some signals, encouraging for the suffs, dismaying for the antis. Since 1910, 11 states had granted women full suffrage, though the antis had managed to temper those victories with a long string of suffrage campaign defeats. Antis managed to thwart suffrage in Oregon 5 times before it passed in 1912. But win or lose, the state referenda proved that millions of American men approved of granting women the vote. Also telling was that in some contests, notably Michigan in 1912, only outright electoral fraud had kept the suffragists from winning, a sure sign that their success was scaring the political powers and stimulating concerted opposition. Congress and other elected officials took notice. The antis were also forced to take notice and began to seriously organize around 1911, after California had granted its women the vote. They kept suffrage at bay in New York in 1915, but it triumphed in 1917, a pivotal loss that spurred new levels of effort. Since America's entry into the World War in 1917, when American women took on new, unorthodox roles, the pace of change had accelerated. Between 1917 and 1920, 11 more states, including Tennessee, had given their women some type of voting rights, perhaps restricted, but still significant. Yet the antis were in no way discouraged. They'd scored impressive victories by halting ratification in 8 states already, stymied legislative action in Vermont and Connecticut, and had several more rejections, North Carolina, Florida, and Tennessee, within sight. They were ready for the challenge in Nashville. On the 7th floor of the Hermitage, Josephine Pearson and her Nashville anti-colleague, Queenie, Mrs. George Washington, were writing to-do lists. Pearson had already reserved the mezzanine and first-floor spaces for the antis' headquarters and reception rooms. They must arrange rallies and receptions, dinners and teas. Social functions were very important, Mrs. Washington insisted. The top officers of the National Association opposed to women's suffrage would be coming to Nashville, as would the leaders of the Southern Women's Rejection League, bringing troops of volunteers. Every ante in Tennessee must be mobilized. Orders must be placed for banners, Confederate flags, and the anti-emblem, red roses from the best florist.